The Immortal Game, episode number 11. The Immortal Game is a San Francisco Chronicle Book of the Year and is available in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com. Chapter 21, Party Time in Pack Heights. I drove back to San Francisco and double parked on Ellis behind my building. That was definitely thumbing my nose at the parking gods, but I didn't plan to be in my office long, and I hoped the placard from the mayor's office would keep the meter maids at bay for the duration of my visit. Mercifully, when I got upstairs, Boniker was nowhere to be seen. I found Gretchen at her desk munching on a tuna fish sandwich with a lot of sprouts and other weedy stuff sticking out of it. She was wearing a black body stocking and a pair of black jeans. Her hair was pulled back in a short ponytail tied with a gold ribbon. "Hi, Augie," she said between bites. "I see the bruises on your face have turned a lovely putrid green. For you, I believe that's the equivalent of rosy cheeks and a healthy glow." "Thanks for noticing," I said dryly. "I wonder what signs your urologist friend looks for in his patients. Rosy cheeks might be one at that." "Don't start with me, August." I held my hands up in a placating gesture. "Just returning serve. Any messages?" "Tony Letts called about a gig tomorrow night. They're playing at Unducci and he wants you to sub for Howie." "Unducci. Good. You can't get a string bass up in that loft anyway. Electronics the only choice." "Why? What's wrong with your bass?" "Nothing. I just took it in to have the keel hauled. Do me a favor. Call him back and tell him I'm on for the gig and get all the details." "Okay. And don't think I'm buying that keel hauling business." I grinned at her and set Nagel's phone bill in the slip of paper with the landlord's phone number down next to her tuna fish sandwich. "Thanks," I said. "You're a doll. Just two more things. Go through that phone bill and find out who all the numbers belong to, particularly the ones in the Bay Area. Just dial and ask if you have to. Second, give that other number a call. It's from a for-rent sign on a vacant house in Daly City. Find out anything you can about the prior tenant, a Mr. Todd Nagel. I especially want to know his forwarding address." Oh joy, another career and wrenching assignment. Better than filing insurance forms for Boniker. Barely. I thanked her with more fervor and went into my office. I didn't expect Teller to be listed in the San Francisco phone directory, and a quick check confirmed my expectations. Plan B in cases like this was to call an acquaintance I had at Pacific Gas and Electric. This was usually cheaper than bribing somebody in the Department of Motor Vehicles, and didn't involve suborning a state employee, something I try to avoid. I got my man, Jason Jones, on the line, and he looked up Roland Teller on his computer. "Sweet," he said. "You're rubbing shoulders with a better grade of people, August. The deadbeats you typically have me run are almost always behind on the utility bill, if we haven't cut them off already. This here's a Pack Heights address. In that part of town, they spend more on personal trainers and pet psychologists than they do on electricity. Of course, I should point out that the bill for this little domicile topped out at $600 last month." "I'll take the address and the phone number," I said, "and hold the jaundiced commentary on the lifestyles of your betters." Jason dictated a phone number and a Lyon Street address to me, finishing with, "And August, please do try to avoid an embarrassing reoccurrence of the sort of problem I alluded to earlier, late payment. I expect to receive my $50 in the next couple of days, or else." "Or else what?" I said, winding him up. "Or else you may experience a sudden and unexpected service outage at your own apartment. But that would be misuse of your authority." "Ain't it the truth?" he said cheerfully. I hung up on him and hustled down to my car. There weren't any tickets on it, but a bulky UPS driver in those ridiculous brown shorts they make them wear was eyeing the car with uncharitable thoughts in his heart. I had blocked his delivery truck next to the curb. "Hey," he said, "you can't just double park wherever you like. Write that one down and tape it to your rearview mirror." I piled into the car and maneuvered it through downtown traffic to Pine Street. I headed west on Pine all the way to Lower Pacific Heights and then went north on Lyon and started up the hill. Pacific Heights wasn't called that for nothing. As I crested the rise of Pacific Avenue, I could see the steel-gray waters of the bay, dotted with sailboats and cut here and there with a white wake of a tugboat or a ferry heading across to the green foothills of Marin County. I had lost track of the street numbers, but I guessed I was in the right vicinity, so I coasted a block further to where Lyon and Broadway both dead-ended and parked at the corner. This was quite the neighborhood. Lining Broadway to the right were some of the most expensive homes in Northern California. They were all shapes and styles, like crazy capped teeth done by different dentists in the same mouth. To the left was the boundary of the Presidio, the sparse branches of wispy cypress trees overhanging the rough rock wall that delineated it. In front of me was a stone balustrade with a break in it for stairs that led sharply down the hill and the resumption of Lyon Street. From the head of the stairs, I could see the pink-hued rotunda of the Palace of Fine Arts, the full sweep of the Marina neighborhood that the 1989 quake had damaged so badly, a thicket of masts from the sailboats tied up at the yacht harbor, and so on to the bay. Runners doing their stair work charged up and down the steps, and a couple sat on the balustrade alternately admiring the view and chewing each other's faces. I trudged back up the hill and soon realized that the rambling Mediterranean-style house on the corner was the one I was after. The Broadway street side was a towering wall of terracotta that rose up from an ivy-covered slope. Screened by eucalyptus and oak, it had a number of false balconies with black trim windows set just under the tile roof to take in the view. Along the Lyon Street side grew more oaks and a monster bottle brush tree. Coming up the sidewalk, I passed a short drive that led to an opening in the wall for a one-spot garage, and following that, a stout wooden door with a weathered brass plaque that read, "Tradesmen's Entrance." I wasn't settling for that, so I went further along the wall until I came to a broad drive paved in brick leading to a courtyard nestled in the wings of the house. Arcaded galleries ran the length of each wing, and at the far end of the courtyard was another, much larger garage with a Lexus and a BMW parked inside. The front door was positioned midway down the near gallery, through an arch partially covered with ivy. There were flashier houses in the neighborhood, but this one had a 1920s elegance that wasn't breaking a sweat to show its class. I was surprised. I had expected something much more parvenu from Teller. I rang the bell, and after a long wait, a blonde woman holding a wine glass opened the door. A snow-white terrier shot out from behind her and attached itself to my leg. "Who are you?" asked the woman in a soft voice. "Buster Brown," I said. I pulled my foot forward, drawing the dog with it. "And this is my dog, Teague." She gave me a worried smile. "I don't think so. Teague was a bulldog. Not that I'm old enough to remember such things." She addressed the dog. "Ransom, get back in the house. Right now." The dog relented and trotted back into the dark interior. I leaned down to put the cuff of my trouser leg right and gave the woman a once-over as I straightened up. She was fairly tall and thin, with hips a little wider and an ass a little flatter than she probably would have liked. Her skin was pale, her mouth and nose small, but her eyes seemed very wide and very green. I had a sudden flash of her as a child, and I guessed that she had been beautiful, but that time and hormones had taken away from that innocent perfection. She was still a handsome woman. On closer inspection, I realized that her hair was not a solid blonde, but was more of an ash blonde with blonder highlights. She held her wine glass in both hands, and there was something curious and graceful about how her long fingers curled around the bowl of it. She was wearing a black and white silk dress with a pair of black flats and sheer white stockings. I guess she was about 40. "Actually," I said, "my name is Reardon, August Reardon. Are you Mrs. Teller?" She hesitated a moment before speaking. "Yes," she said. "Please excuse the dog, Mr. Reardon. He doesn't get enough exercise. I do hope you're not selling anything." "No, I'm not. I'm investigating the death of your husband." More hesitation, then. "But I've already spoken with several of your colleagues. The most recent, I believe, was a Detective Stockwell." "I know. I met with him earlier today. I'm not a member of the police force, Mrs. Teller. I was hired by Edwin Bishop. As I'm sure you know, Mr. Bishop had some business dealings with your husband, dealings of a somewhat disputed nature. The McCullough woman, in whose apartment your husband's body was found, was a former employee of Mr. Bishop." The woman in front of me sighed, and her face took on a faraway look. For the first time, I realized she was tranquilized to the gills. "And you are the detective that found my husband. I understand now." Yes, I know this must be a very difficult time for you, Mrs. Teller, but I was hoping you could see your way clear to answer a few questions. I can't change what's happened, but there's some reason to believe that the interpretation of events the police have is not correct. I'm not convinced that your husband, well, that your husband was sleeping with Mrs. McCullough. It was clear Detective Stockwell thought so. She brushed a non-existent hair from her face. I've promised to go to this wretched open house. I'd sooner walk barefoot over hot coals. But I'm very active on several charitable boards, and in spite of what's happened, I can't afford to drop out of the circuit altogether. And, to be brutally honest, I don't want people gossiping about me in my absence. Anyway, I must leave in another 15 minutes. I'll give you that much time if you like. Thank you. I appreciate it very much. Please come in, then. I'm having some wine and cheese to fortify myself for the party. Would you care to join me? I made a show of glancing at my watch. I don't know, I said. It is a little early in the day for cheese. She laughed. It was a pleasant-sounding laugh, but it seemed to take a lot out of her. She looked at me thoughtfully. I have a better idea. Come with me to the open house. We can talk there. Would that be a good idea? I sputtered. I'm sure your friends would think it odd that I came. They might think it odd, but you would be ever so helpful as protection. So, what do you say? I'm leaving now with or without you. Your only chance to talk is to come along. You want to use me for protection? From what? From the Pacific Heights Inquisition. From the false pity and sympathy that will flood over me the moment I walk through the door. I guess you could call that using you, Mr. Reardon. But after all, you wish to use me as well. A fair exchange of services. That will be our goal. And from what I've seen of your rather rough-hewn wit, I don't think you will disappoint. Great. Just let me know when you want me to spit on the carpet. That ought to be rough-hewn enough for them. Are we walking or driving? I suppose we could walk, but I'm really not in the mood for fresh air. Do you have a car? Would you mind driving us? Yes to the first question and no to the second, I said. She went back into the house, leaving the door open. I waited outside. She returned a moment later with a purse and long coat, which she had draped over her arm. She locked up and we walked down to the Galaxy, where I opened the passenger door for her. What in the world happened to your back seat? She asked as she sat down. Back seat? I said. There's no back seat on these babies, Mrs. Teller. It's a two-seater sport model. Here I thought a Galaxy 500 was a family sedan. We're just going up the street to Broadway and Steiner, and perhaps you shouldn't call me Mrs. Teller. My first name is Margaret. Do you mind if I call you August? That would be spiffy. I started the car and pointed it down the street. This was going to be a trip of about 6 blocks. Who are our hosts? There's only one. His name is Brad Wilford. He's just gotten back from an archaeological dig. His house is being refurbished, so he's leased the penthouse suite in an apartment building during the construction. This party is sort of a combination housewarming and hello, I'm back in town for him. So he's an archaeologist? Where was he working? Margaret Teller let out another heavy sigh. Yes, he's an archaeologist, a mountain climber, an artist, a bicycle racer, a professional student, and a one-time fiancé of mine. His family has money, so he's never actually held a paying job. He just dabbles. I don't know where the digs were exactly. Somewhere in the Middle East. I was stuck behind a pickup truck with lawn equipment and bags of cut grass. As it crept to a stop at the intersection in front of us, I had a sudden desire to jump out of the car and leap onto the back of it. I wasn't liking the setup for this party at all. We drove several more blocks in silence until we came to Steiner. Margaret Teller said, "Here we are," and gestured to the left. On that side of the street was 5 stories of squat, cream-colored brick building. 2 valets in short red jackets stood in front on the walk. Another came up to the car window. "Are you here for the Wilford open house?" he asked. I nodded, and he told me to pull my car around to the other side of the street. I did so, and the 2 guys on the sidewalk decanted Margaret Teller out of the Galaxy, while I fended for myself. If they thought the car didn't belong in the neighborhood, they didn't say anything. At the front door was another guy in some kind of servant getup. He held open the door for us and gestured to the elevator. Standing there was yet another guy in uniform. He smiled, told us to get off on the top floor. As the doors pulled back at the end of the ride, a 6th person in uniform, this time a middle-aged Latino woman, led us down a short corridor to the only door in the hall. She pulled it open and held it while we walked into the room beyond. "What?" I said. "No announcement as we enter?" Whatever response Margaret Teller made to that was lost in the suffocating yammer of 30 or 40 people who had already availed themselves of at least 2 cocktails apiece. We were in a wide-open room with a wall of glass at the back, affording an excellent view of the bay, several pieces of heavy furniture pushed against the sides, and an expensive-looking oriental rug that covered all but a thin margin of the hardwood floor. There was nothing special about the people except they talked a little better, dressed a little better, and rattled a little more jewelry than the equivalent number of general populace pulled at random off Market Street. I snagged a pair of champagne flutes from a silver tray being circulated by another servant, and returned to Margaret Teller's side to await developments. They weren't long in coming. A gangly, yeasty-looking guy who was balding in back made a show of catching Margaret's eye from across the room. He arrived next to us with a hangdog grin and some crumbs from an hors d'oeuvre trailing down the front of his well-pressed cambric shirt. "Margaret," he said, "I'm so glad that you made it. I'm so sorry about Roland. How are you holding up?" Then, seeming to notice me for the first time, "Oh, pardon me, I'm Brad Wilford." He put out his hand. I gave him my name and shook his hand, despite its seeming lack of endoskeleton. "I'm fine, Brad," said Margaret Teller, "at least for now. Dr. Hines has taken pity on me and refilled my Valium prescription. I can cope as long as those hold out." Wilford reached across to take Margaret's upper arm and squeezed it. "We'll have dinner soon and talk. Things will work out for the best, believe me. I know they have when I faced hardship. To be honest, I didn't achieve the success I hoped at the site in Syria, but I've already found a new lease with my digital photography. You'll find something, too." "Yes, Brad," said Margaret with another sigh. Wilford glanced at me again. "Well, I must circulate. Please take care of yourself, and I will call you soon. Oh, and nice to meet you, August." After he had gone, I said, "Sorry, I don't think I was much help."
"No, you were a great help," said Margaret. "Didn't you see how rattled he was by your presence? He can't figure out what you're doing here, but is too polite to ask."
She tilted her head back and down the remainder of her champagne. Tears squeezed out from the corners of her eyes. "The idiot, as if taking up something like digital photography could replace a husband." "Maybe this isn't such a good idea," I said, suddenly developing a case of the guilts. "Maybe we should leave. My questions can wait until another time." Margaret Teller shook her head and dabbed at her eyes with a knuckle. "No, I've got to run the gauntlet sooner or later. It's best to get it over with." The gauntlet, as she put it, consisted of a string of encounters with 8 or 9 more people. 3 of them were former beaux, including another man to whom she had been engaged. When I questioned her about the high density of ex-boyfriends, she explained, "Wealthy society in San Francisco is very insular. We like to think we're big town stuff like New York or even L.A., but we're not. We don't even have the heritage like Boston. We just pretend to. What you end up with is this little group of people throwing parties for each other, writing articles in the Nob Hill Gazette about each other, and sleeping around with each other. We're more inbred than the Appalachian hillbillies, and a damn sight less honest about it. That was one of the reasons I married Roland. He wasn't part of this. At least, he wasn't at the beginning. When I met him, he was like a breath of fresh air, a self-made man who worked hard for a living and wanted, I mean really wanted, to raise a family." I was eager to get her talking about Teller, but at that point a couple came through the door that made Margaret visibly wince.
"This is where you might want to spit on the rug," she said.
"Who are they?"
"It's Milton Carroll III and the woman he's currently seeing, Erica Stevens. I went to school with her. He comes from a family of very successful writers, and he tries hard to wear the mantle, but the truth is he's nothing but a hack. His last effort was a coffee table book about tequila. He's a horrid, unctuous man. I was once in group therapy with him, and he confessed to the group that he was stalking his former girlfriend because she dumped him. He demanded our sympathy for his actions."
Carroll and Stevens made straight for Margaret as soon as they spotted her. He was a short man of about 45 years with a fringe of brown hair surrounding an oddly shaped bald head. His features were heavy and plain, and he was wearing a blue blazer with tan slacks. The woman seemed to be about Margaret's age, but she was working harder to hide it. She had dark hair and dark skin, and was wearing a dress that showed a little too much of her meager breasts. She looked about as hard to get as the time of day.
Margaret, said Milton Carroll effusively, I want you to know how wretched I feel about Roland's death. You must be absolutely devastated. Still, you've managed to make it out in public before the funeral, and with an escort, no less. What strength you must have. Bully for you, Margaret.
The coroner's holding Roland's body, Margaret Taylor said almost inaudibly. We can't have the funeral until it's released.
My God, you've really been through a lot, haven't you? Said Erica Stevens, putting an oar in with a vengeance. First the news that you can't have children, then the separation, now this. I guess you are just inured to heartache, dear.
I'm sure friends like you have done a lot to help, I said quickly.
Stevens got a funny look on her face as she thought that one over.
Say, I said to him, aren't you Milton Carroll III?
Carroll grinned and puffed up about 3 sizes bigger.
Yes, that's right, he said.
Your father was quite the writer, I said with enthusiasm. Must be hard to follow in his footsteps.
What was it William Faulkner said? Nobody is going to remember William Faulkner's son, or something like that.
Still, I just saw a book of yours.
Oh?
Yeah, at a garage sale. I had no idea tequila was made from cactus juice. Fascinating stuff.
Carol got an expression like he'd eaten some bad kimchi and maneuvered the conversation to a close. He and Erica Stevens walked off. Margaret Taylor watched them go with more tears welling at the corners of her eyes, but she said,
You are like a nuclear retaliation. I should have ordered a preemptive first strike.
I don't know. A punch in the mouth would have been more effective and satisfying. Now how about we go somewhere quiet where we can talk? We wended our way through the social register until we found a small, unoccupied study at the back of the penthouse. I closed the door on the buzz of the cocktail party, and we sat down on a green leather sofa in front of a fire going great guns in a marble mantled fireplace.
This is much better, said Margaret Taylor.
Maybe you won't feel that way after I start grilling you, I said.
No. Anything would be an improvement over what I went through out there.
Yeah, I guess so. You mentioned earlier that you were attracted to Roland Taylor because he wasn't part of San Francisco society. How did you meet him then?
He came to a party for the opening of the opera. A lot of executives from Silicon Valley make it up for the opening. I mean, few men really like the opera. Certainly Roland couldn't have cared less for it. But the opening is always a big thing. The party is hosted every year by a group of young business professionals. There are always a lot of single people there, and it's a good opportunity to meet someone.
Erica Stevens said that you were separated. May I ask why?
Margaret Taylor looked down and pulled at an upholstery button on the sofa. It's not what you think, she said. It's not because he was having an affair with another woman. One reason was the strain my inability to have children put on the marriage. We both wanted so very badly to raise a family, and I had gotten to the age where getting pregnant was no mean feat. Roland was several years younger than I, you see, but that wasn't the underlying cause. The underlying cause was those people out there, those lovely people out there. She brought her eyes up to mine. In fact, it's not overstating it to say that they are responsible for his death.
I can't even see your dust on that one.
They warped him. When I met him, he was a relatively unsophisticated man who had made good by hard work and perseverance. I was part of this world, true, but he was not. But the more contact he had with it, the more the Pacific Heights crowd let him know in subtle and not so subtle ways that he wasn't quite their caliber of person. He became very sensitive to slights, both real and imagined, at home, in the workplace, or on social occasions. And to change his standing in their eyes, he started doing everything he could to accumulate and flaunt more wealth and social position. I had money from my family, and he had amassed quite a respectable fortune from his business, but it wasn't enough. We overextended ourselves to buy that mansion. It cost well over $5 million, and he started running his business ruthlessly, without regard for risk, trying to squeeze as much income as he could from it.
I think I know where you're going with this. You're saying he wouldn't have made the deal for Bishop Software if he wasn't so concerned about the bottom line.
Not that he wouldn't have made the deal. It would have been an eminently reasonable thing to do. But he never would have negotiated with this Terry McCullough person. He knew there was something wrong about her from the start. In fact, he told me he had broken off negotiations with her at one point.
So you spoke about it, I said.
Margaret Taylor nodded and looked into the fire.
Yes, we still spoke regularly, even during the separation. He said that he had a meeting with her and he came away very skeptical that she had the authority to negotiate for Bishop, even though the software she demonstrated was impressive.
Later, he told her he wasn't interested.
When did he change his mind?
I'm not entirely sure. The only hint I had was several weeks later when he told me that he had a big moneymaker at work and he hoped it would redeem him in my eyes.
She stifled a sob and looked up at the ceiling. Now the tears were really flowing.
He still hadn't gotten it. He still thought I was judging him by the way everyone else in Pacific Heights did.
Watching this was no fun. Everything I'd seen of Teller said he was a horse's ass, but there must have been something decent in him to evoke this sort of response. Or maybe she was crying for herself. There was a pile of cocktail napkins on the coffee table in front of us. I took one off the stack and handed it to her, then patted her shoulder awkwardly.
So what if our goofy host, Brad Wilford, chose that exact moment to stick his head through the study door? There wouldn't have been a good time.
What kind of shenanigans are going on in here? He said affably.
Oh, it's you, Margaret. Please excuse me.
Margaret Teller stood up quickly, dabbing at her eyes.
No need to apologize, Brad. I was just crying on August's shoulder.
She looked over at me. But I think perhaps we should go. I'm no good to anyone at this point.
We said our goodbyes to Wilford and then went back through the penthouse and down to the street. The party crowd had thinned out, but those who were left had compensated by cranking up the volume of their cocktail chit-chat in direct correlation to the number of drinks they'd imbibed. Outside it was growing dark and a stiff breeze had come up from the bay. The valet on duty said, "Oh, you had the old Ford, didn't you?" before I even approached him. When he brought the car around, I tipped him $2 and told him I preferred the term classic to old. I drove Margaret Teller back to her house and then got out to walk her to her door. We hadn't spoken since we left the study, but as we came under the arch at the front entrance, I said, "Sorry to keep hammering on this, but in terms of actually pulling the trigger, you don't have any reason to doubt that Terry McCullough is responsible. I mean, Roland didn't say anything to you about anyone else who was involved in the deal."
Her face seemed very pale in the darkness.
"No," she said. "I'm satisfied she killed him. I think Roland decided to buy the software from her, even though he knew it was stolen. I doubt he even pretended to believe her. My guess is he told her right out that he thought he was buying stolen property in order to get the best deal from her. He was just that driven to make money."
"But how could he expect that Bishop would hold still for it? And if he had bought it from McCullough with the understanding that it was stolen, why would she kill him later?"
Margaret Teller let out another sigh, a sigh that had the weight of all her suffering behind it.
"I'm just guessing, Mr. Reardon. I mean, August. But what could Mr. Bishop do but take Roland to court? It would take years to settle, and by then Roland would have reaped most of the benefits from being first to market with a unique product. Even if he lost the suit in the end, it had to compensate Mr. Bishop. As a matter of fact, Roland and Bishop once had a dispute over a similar matter. Bishop claimed that Roland's company had copied the user interface for one of his games. Roland told me it all came to naught because Bishop's counsel advised him against bringing any action. The cost and risk of a judgment in Roland's favor were just too high. As to why Terry McCullough would kill Roland, many reasons occur to me. She wanted more money. She was angry that Roland had implicated her. Perhaps Roland even refused to pay her the sum they had agreed upon. I know one thing for certain. They did not have a lover's quarrel. Roland had changed, but he would never have had an affair behind my back."
I took a card from my wallet and handed it to her. I said, "If there's ever anything you need..." On impulse, I leaned over and kissed her cheek. Her skin beneath my lips felt soft and very cold. I turned quickly and walked out of the courtyard. On the drive home, I felt oppressed by a vague sadness that even listening to the happy horns of Terry Clark could not stave off.
You have been listening to The Immortal Game, a San Francisco Chronicle Book of the Year. You can find it in ebook and trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Hear more at patreon.com/markcoggins or author website markcoggins.com.